topic is really, really interesting. If you want to know more, you should go talk to people like Hiro Nishikawa or Siwon Law, who are in the audience. So, but let me just say, so we're talking about a period of history, World War II, and a very tiny ethnic group, which makes it really easy to overlook the kinds of impact that they had. But if you go for the students here who are from high school, you want to raise your hands, the high school students? All right. If you ever are silly enough to consider law as a career, you will study at least the Korematsu case, but probably the Hirabayashi case as well, as Supreme Court cases. So these are cases that are not just important to one minority group. They're important to the Constitution and the fabric of American society. And there are a lot of things like that that are sometimes hidden from ordinary view. And I'll just say, by way of context, that the United States Congress has apologized 5 times in its history. Now, depending on your point of view, you might think, my goodness, they should have apologized a lot more than that. Or why did they apologize for 5 at all? So that's sort of a litmus test about how we do. But if the only time the United States has both apologized and paid out reparations or redress has been for the unconstitutional, illegal incarceration of 120,000 people of Japanese descent who were in the United States in 1942. The other times that Congress has apologized include for the passage of the Chinese Exclusion Act and the acts around there in 1882, when the United States declared for the first time in its history that the Chinese were persona non grata, who could not come in except for selected groups, and could not become naturalized citizens in the United States. So it was a way of defining ourselves by who we excluded. The third one was for the illegal overthrow of the Hawaiian kingdom. So I'm from Hawaii, so this is very personal to me. But so if you follow politics in my state, the 50th state in the Union, you will know that there are Native Hawaiian groups who are tremendously fractious and opinionated about how they should go about getting proper recognition for their status. The other two, if you're interested, are slavery and treatment of Native Americans. So those are the 5 times that Congress has apologized. Well, maybe one of the other ways of looking at this event or this series of events is to sort of understand that this was the largest forced relocation, removal and relocation in American history. Now, when I first heard that, I said, you gotta be kidding. What about like the Trail of Tears? The Native American removal from Georgia to Oklahoma. Well, that group was much more harshly treated, and a lot of people died on that, on the Trail of Tears. There were Japanese Americans who died or were killed in camps. So, but not, the treatment was hardly of the at the level that Native Americans had to endure under President Jackson's regime. So here we are. Gordon Hirabayashi was one of the 4 cases that reached the Supreme Court. Fred Korematsu, Min Yasui, Mitsue Endo, were the three others. They all, Mitsui Endo's case was a case of habeas corpus, and she alleged that the federal government was keeping her confined in these camps, which some people call concentration camps. FDR called it concentration camps. A lot of scholars today will insist that you use that term. They're not death camps, as the German camps were in Europe. But you have to think back to when people were removed, ordered from their homes at bayonet point, herded onto trains and buses, taken someplace they knew not for however long a period of time, they had no idea. And under what circumstances they did not know. So the anxiety and the torment was real and very difficult. Minya Sui and Gordon Hirabayashi challenged the first part of the laws, which were directed at the Japanese Americans and were curfew laws, that where people were ordered to be off the streets by 8 until 6 the next morning, or whatever the hours were, depending on the locale. And Gordon was one of the ones who said, you know, he was a university student at the University of Washington, and he said, you know, my friends are studying. I would like to be in the library as well. They didn't have laptops then. So they needed books. So he said, well then, if this is not applying, this curfew isn't applying to all my classmates, then this is not right that it should apply to me. So this is the story that you're going to be exposed to in the play, in the excerpts. So I'm going to stop there, except to tell you one last thing, which is when these cases went to the Supreme Court, except for Mitsui Endo, all of the men were convicted. And it wasn't until the 1980s that their cases were revived in the federal court system. And what we learned was that the executive branch of the United States, in those trials in 1943 and 1944, deliberately fabricated evidence to try to show that there was a military danger existing if these Japanese Americans were free and allowed to be free. And so their cases were vacated in the 1980s. Anyway, so this is just a small part of what is an extraordinary history that would be good for you to see the play and come back here to take a look at the documents. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I now want to introduce Daniel Student, who is the director at Plays and Players Play Theater.
Not important, it's okay. My name is Daniel Student. I'm the artistic director of Plays and Players Theater. I'm also the director of Hold These Truths, which you're about to see an excerpt from. First, I want to say thank you to Dr. Odo. Makoto and I were just smiling back there because yesterday in rehearsal, we were approaching how to make the first time we see Gordon in the play. He's in his 60s. He's been a college professor for years, and he's giving you a lecture. And we just had a firsthand idea of how to do that, so thank you for that. Our eyes were bulging, like, oh, this is how it should be. So an apology ahead of time, because we rescheduled a week, Makoto and I are in rehearsal literally right now. This is my working script. We are going to do the performance and have to run. So I promise to reach out to every one of you through the mailing list that Chris emails, you know, through Chris to just say hello and welcome you back to the theater if you want to come back in February. In brief, Hold These Truths runs February 12th to March 1st, a three-week run at Plays and Players Theater, which is just five blocks away near Rittenhouse Square. We are an over 100-year-old theater company running an over 100-year-old theater building. It's a really special place. Also, if you haven't been to our third floor studio, there's also a bar right next door, so it's a good night out. maybe not exactly what you'd connect to Japanese internment as a piece that you focus on. But and we do have a lot of great special events. I'm so excited. Hiro Nishikawa is here. He's going to be after our second Sunday performance, which is the 22nd. He and three other internment survivors are going to be there talking after the show. After our first Sunday performance, the 15th, the American Friends Service Committee Executive Secretary Shan Creighton is going to be there, along with the playwright Jeannie Sakata, who's flying in from Los Angeles just to have this talk back. We have a great event on the 19th with the Historical Society. So there's a lot of community action around this play, and that's the one message I want to say. It's been a real delight for us to be part of that and for me personally to learn things. The great example of concentration camp was not a word I used before, and having been a descendant from the concentration camps and death camps in Europe, it's been really powerful for me to claim that word about what we did in this country. And the last thing that you did so well to set us up is we're actually going to start the scene right after Gordon decides to break the curfew. So I'm going to call up our wonderful performer, Makoto Hirano, who I know very well but don't know his bio by heart, so I'm going to just do a very brief version of it. He's a Philadelphia-based dance, theater, and spoken word artist. His award-winning ensemble and solo performance works have been presented nationally in numerous venues and festivals, including the Philadelphia Live Arts Festival, Yale University, and off-Broadway at the National Asian American Theater Festival. He's had performer-collaborator highlights, including working with Bill Irwin, Pig Iron Theater Company, Subcircle, Kate Watson Wallace, Anonymous Bodies, Nicole Canuso Dance Company, and Thaddeus Phillips Lucidity Suitcase International. He's been funded by every organization in town. He's also a co-founder of the Team Sunshine Performance Corporation, where he's a co-creator and administrator of all projects and events. A former U.S. Marine, Makoto studied dance at Columbia College Chicago and earned his BFA at Temple University. With a little support from me reading a couple sound effects, I welcome Makoto Hirano to the stage.
Hello, all. I'm going to go rogue for a sec. I'm going to invite everybody to stand just for, it's going to be 30 seconds. We're just going to just kind of just shake your bodies out a little bit, just to break it up a little bit. So we're, maybe shake your leg out, shake your left leg out just a tiny bit, shake your right leg out. Maybe a gentle roll. Hey, yawn, if you can do it. And, all right, let's all, yeah, okay, good. I think we'll take a seat. Thank you so much. Okay, I just wanted to break that up a little bit. Okay, you're going to start?
Yeah.
Okay.
Instructions to all persons of Japanese ancestry. All persons of Japanese ancestry, both alien and non-alien, will be evacuated for the following areas by 12 o'clock noon. All that portion of King County, beginning at the intersection of Roosevelt Way and East 85th Street. Then easterly along East 85th Street, extended to Lake Washington. Then south along the shoreline of Lake Washington to Yester Way. Then westerly along Yester Way to 15th Avenue.
No, they can't do this. We're American citizens. I stand there for a very long time, letting the shock run through me. If anything happens to the Issei, they'll do the same to Yunisei. That's what Mom has said. That's what a lot of the Issei had said, and I hadn't believed it. I never believed. Despite the firestorm of demands erupting along the coast, fueled by the War Department, who insisted we were a security threat and wanted all of us out, demands for our removal now exploding in the halls of Congress. But President Roosevelt would never let this happen. I said it over and over. The Attorney General, the Justice Department, they'd never let it happen. We were born here. We belong here. The Constitution protects us. The Constitution, the humiliation. The mass exodus begins. Beginning with Bainbridge Island, every district around Seattle rushes to meet its deadline to expel all people with Japanese blood living within its borders. We can only carry two suitcases apiece. And we only have 1 week to get rid of everything else we own. So we haul it all to the front yard. Stove, icebox, washing machine, table, sofa, rocking chair. Mom's Edison phonograph. Her black walnut piano. And Dad, he burns photos, family treasures, anything suggesting ties to Japan. Bargain hunters, scavengers, they swarm over our belongings.
Sound cue, Japanese voices over a loudspeaker. Japanese evacuee must sell 1937 Pontiac coupe. Four very good tires, A1 mechanical condition. Cash, $250. Japanese evacuee must sell 50-room brick hotel. Linens, furnishings, steam heat. Living quarters, garage. Japanese evacuee must sell fruit market. Complete stock, fixtures, scales, cash register. Full price, $300.
The losses are staggering. And through it all, utter confusion. My name is Hazel Wu, and this is my sister Grace. Our mother is Japanese, but our father is Chinese-American. Will we have to leave? I am Father Lavery of the Mary Knoll School. We have an orphanage with children of Japanese ancestry. Some of these children are half Japanese, others one-fourth or less. Which children should we send? At the end of winter quarter in March, I drop out of the university. And since my district is the last to go, I sign up with the American Friends Service Committee, a Quaker group helping families move. We pack boxes, arrange for storage, and prepare the children to carry their things on their long trek to where? Where are we going? And for how long? Nobody has a clue. I drive them to the Puyallup Fairground Assembly Center, where they'll stay till they're shipped to their final destination. Puyallup, where we'd always go for the annual county fair, where we'd pitch pennies, eat hot dogs, ride the Ferris wheel. But now when we arrive, barbed wire, miles of it, stretched across wooden posts, snaking across the fairgrounds, surrounding the entire... They're putting us behind it. Like pigs. Like cattle. Like over there, by the grandstands. They're putting us into horse stalls. The stench, I can smell it from where I stand. May 10th, the day arrives. The notice went up for my district. Everyone with 1/16th Japanese blood must go. 1 week until the day of departure. 1 week, 7 days. So I start to pack. Friends drop in to say goodbye, and there are lots of tears and hugs, so many I have trouble getting it done. I have to rush to finish, and I drop a book. Freshman Civics. America, the land of the free. We the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, secure the blessings of liberty. The blessings of liberty. And those words burn on that textbook page. No person shall be held to answer for a capital crime unless on an indictment of a grand jury, nor be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. I phone my friend Art Barnett, a young Quaker attorney, and I tell him I've got some questions. I grill him on the Fifth Amendment and Gord, why are you asking? What are you up to, Gord? I hang up the phone. I get my Nisei buddy Bill to come over before I can change my mind. And after we agonize all night, we shake hands, declaring we'll buck this thing together. But only a few hours later, Bill. Gordy, I gotta talk to you, Gordy. I just can't do it. My parents are getting on, you know, and I'm an only child, and so all they have is me, and if something were to happen to them, I would never... Good luck, Gordy. You got a lot of guts. Bill's situation is different from mine. My brothers can look after my folks. They won't be left alone. But back in my room at night, I stare at the ceiling, unable to sleep. Heart is pounding. Stomach's churning. Because now I'm on my own. And it gets worse from there. Mom, I break the news to her that night, but the word's already spread like wildfire. She sits there, calmly, arms folded. She tells me she agrees. She praises me for courageous choice. But these are dangerous times. If I don't go with our family, we may forever be separated, she says. Rumors are flying up the coast that we'll be thrown into jail for years, shipped back to Japan for good, taken to the desert, shot. Mom, please, listen to me. Eddie and Jim aren't kids anymore. They can take care of themselves, and you and Dad and Dick and Tosh, you don't need me to go with you. No, you have a special duty. You are the Chonan, eldest son. Then she lets me have it. Our home is being flooded, she says. Our home is being flooded with phone calls hourly from friends, relatives, neighbors, Japanese community leaders. You've got to make him change his mind. You've got to make him understand. We have to obey the government. We have to prove our loyalty. Look what they're doing to us. They're terrified. You make them suspect too. How can you put them in danger? How can you be so selfish? Mom, when I was 5 years old and we were at the Seattle Sears and that guard was staring and staring at you and you said if they accused you of stealing, that you would protest and you would sue the police. And then you and Dad lost the farming commune because of the alien land law. And then you went to court to fight it. And we lost. We lost. Yes, but you tried. Do you have any idea what the government could do to you? They might beat you, torture you, or leave you to starve and die. Or throw you into the dungeon like Count of Monte Cristo. I may never see you again. Gordon, anata wa chōnan desu. You have a responsibility. Yes, I have a responsibility to live by my own principles. Justice once, put principle aside. Gordon, onegai. Mom, no. Let me go. I'm going to do this. I am. And my words hit her like a gunshot. And we stare at each other. Mother and son. And I can see my face in hers. And then she crumbles. She falls to her knees and weeps. Mom. We part ways. May 13th, 1942. Over and above any man-made law is the natural law of life, the right of human individuals to life and to creatively express themselves. No man was born with the right to limit that law. This order for the mass evacuation of all persons of Japanese descent denies them the right to live. It forces thousands of energetic, law-abiding individuals to exist in a miserable, psychological, and horrible atmosphere. It kills the desire for a higher life. Hope for the future is exterminated. Human personalities are poisoned. Over 60% are American citizens, yet they are denied without due process of law the civil liberties, which are theirs. If I were to register and cooperate under these circumstances, I would be giving helpless consent to the denial of practically all of the things which give me incentive to live. I consider it my duty to maintain the democratic standards for which this nation lives. Therefore, I must refuse this order for evacuation. Signed, Gordon K. Hirabayashi.
Mr. Hirabayashi, you're under arrest.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. That was really great. And again, the full play is going to open on February 12th, so I hope everybody gets a chance to go see it. And now I'd like to reintroduce Dr. Odo and bring Ms. Sumiko Kobayashi up to the table. Sorry about that. And where they'll discuss, kind of put in context what you just heard, and then take questions. So please join me in re-welcoming Dr. Odo and welcoming Ms. Kobayashi.
I don't know what we're supposed to do, but I think this is Sumiko's turn to sort of talk about your personal experience, where you grew up and which camp you were in, and a little bit about that to get us started.
All right. My voice does not carry, I know that. Oh, there. My name is Sumiko Kobayashi. Kobayashi is a common name in Japan, but like Smith or Brown over here. I was born in Florida, where my father was part of a Japanese agricultural colony. He was a doctor's son. He didn't know anything about farming, but they hired people to do the actual farming and packing. So They started with pineapples, but it was hit by a blight, and they had competition from Cuba, so they switched. Can you hear me?
Yes.
The group, which was never large, it was a village of about 44 young men mostly. There were very few families, but this was near Palm Beach. They grew tomatoes and peppers and beans and shipped them north when the fields here were under snow, like now. my father was a relative by marriage of the leader of the colony. So he went to Florida, emigrated to Florida, and about a few years later, when his family decided he should get married, so this was common in Japan. Even in Japan, they didn't meet one another. It was mostly a family affair anyway. You know, the play or musical Dolly. anyway, they got the services of a baishakunin, which is another Japanese name for
a go-between.
Go-between. So they exchanged letters and pictures, and either side had the ability to say no. My mother's older sister was a local beauty, so she turned down about four or five offers, I think, before she finally got married. Well, anyway, eventually my father returned to Japan, married my mother, and so I was born near Palm Beach. In fact, I was born in a maternity hospital in West Palm Beach. Then about 2 years later, the Florida East Coast Railroad was very busy because they were building Miami Beach, and land prices shot way up, so most of the Japanese colonists sold their land. And my father had been invited by a millionaire cotton broker, I guess he was. He had a 300-acre estate on the Fox River. Anybody near know the Chicago area, the Fox River? Oh. did you live there? Well, anyway, we grew up. I had a younger brother and a sister come along while we were in Geneva, and we grew up in the in a small town suburb of Chicago called Geneva. The owner had a 300-acre private estate, and so it was nice. Nice place to grow up, roam around. There was a big Dutch-style windmill, which was a local landmark, and they had animals of all kinds. They had cage animals, and they had alligators, which they put in the conservatory in the winter because, of course, it goes down below zero in the Chicago area. And so we lived there. We grew up. I had a younger brother and younger sister who came along, and I went to the local public school. I was told that if I had stayed there until high school graduation, the class would have numbered 44 graduates. Unheard of today. So after the owners died, the estate, private estate, was sold to the county for a public park. It had a one-acre Japanese garden, which is still people like to take pictures there. It's the site of weddings, and it's not like it was when we were living there. But it's still a nice place to visit. I'm glad it didn't get broken up and die. We lived there from the time I was between age 2 and age 16 when the owners died and the estate became a public park, which it is today, including the Japanese garden. A lot of people like to take pictures there. And so we moved to San Leandro, California. Anybody know the West Coast? Lots. Do you know the Bay region? Yeah. So we went to San Leandro, and my father worked for a nurseryman, they call it, raising roses and carnations, shipping them south to Los Angeles. I think maybe it was too warm in Los Angeles for roses. Anyway, we moved there in 1939, November 1939, and I remember being surprised by, when we reached Oakland, palm trees. I never expected that. Well, anyway, this was 1939, so I graduated from San Leandro High School. San Leandro was a small community which shared a border with Oakland. The southern border of Oakland was the northern border of San Leandro. So I was I graduated from San Leandro High School. I took the subject day exam. Anybody here from University of California, Berkeley? Oh, you know about subject day exam then? The subject day exam is one they give entering freshmen. It's an essay contest. And if you pass that, then you don't have to take English composition. It's great, great system. So I took the subject day exam and passed that. And this was June of 1941. So I took a summer job. I think I was drying apricots out in the sun. This was June 1941 when I graduated from San Leandro High School. And then came December 7th, 1941. I guess there's nobody who doesn't know what that meant. Anyway, we didn't know what was going to happen to us. There was great discrimination against Japanese, Chinese too, but they came to the United States before the Japanese, so they were a little farther along. We didn't know what was going to happen to us. Well, then on December 7th was Pearl Harbor Day, and in February, President Roosevelt signed Executive Order 1066-1066, which told the military to round up all these people who, after Pearl Harbor, President Roosevelt declared war. So we were at war with Germany, Italy, and Japan. So we didn't know what was going to happen to us. Well, after that executive order was signed, the military was given the job of rounding up all the Japanese citizens. Aliens and non-aliens. They didn't want to call us citizens. Aliens and non-aliens. So I was a non-alien, born in the United States, and therefore citizen by birthright. We waited, and I should have brought a likeness of the orders that were posted on buildings and on telephone poles, ordering all Japanese to report to a certain place. And in our case, it was a local place where some ladies were giving out coffee, maybe milk for the children. But we were put on army buses and taken to Tanforan. Tanforan. And some of you know Tanforan is
racetrack, huh?
It's a racetrack. Racing was stopped at same thing happened to Santa Anita in Los Angeles. So the we were told to report to a certain place. They had these posters. I should have brought a facsimile of one, but we were put on army buses guarded by soldiers. Mine Okubo, an artist from Riverside, California, who was traveling in Europe when it looked like war was imminent, so she cut short her trip and came back home. So she has a book, Citizens 1066, which I meant to bring a copy along. Maybe the library here has a copy of Mine Okubo's book. But she kept a running artist's diary of the whole evacuation process.
Yeah. Great book. So where were you after Tanforan? So yeah. you were. What kind of housing did you have? What did you live
well,
in?
Horse racing was shut down as a frivolous activity. That happened to Santa Anita in Los Angeles also. Some families were placed in whitewashed horse stalls. You can still smell the former occupants and see. Some wags put up a sign, home of Seabiscuit. Seabiscuit was a popular horse race. There was a book written about Seabiscuit. We were fortunate. We didn't have to smell the horse stalls. We were put in Army-style barracks, which they built on the infield of Tanforan. While I was in Tanforan, which was about 6 months, 5 months, did not have a job, so I made some sketches, which the society here has.
You should know, she's a very skilled artist, because on the table in the back are sketches of, this is Tanforan,
yes.
The sketches that give you a real kind of feel for, I think, better than photographs of the what the barracks looked like and what kind of conditions they had to live in.
They served meals. We weren't supposed no cooking in the barracks or the horse stalls. We had to go to the grandstand, three shifts for each meal, and they had a fence around. Some people had. Friends bring them things like one of the people that I knew said that a friend had bought a cake and birthday cake and they examined. They had sensors too, looking at the mail going incoming and outgoing, and so one other person that I heard, somebody brought a birthday cake, and a guard started slashing, looking for hidden weapons.
Terrible.
Yeah.
So where did you go from Tanforan?
From Tanforan, we went to Tanforan in May. 1942. Mm-hmm. In the next 5 months or so, they built 10 relocation centers, they called them. It was no longer under the auspices of the Army. It was a civilian organization, the War Relocation Authority, took it over. So we were put on a train. We were sent to Topaz, Utah, the jewel of the desert, surrounded by barbed wire with watchtowers and guards. In fact, this happened in some other places too, but the guards were in watchtowers with searchlights pointed in, not out. Looking for people trying to break in. Well, nobody wanted to break in. And the people, we were in the Utah desert, sagebrush, tumbling tumbleweeds, coyotes.
The nearest, I've been there, actually. I'm serving on a scholarly advisory group for Topaz Museum, which is building a museum. And they actually have the building there, and there is an art show up already. Topaz was, as Sumiko says, one of the 10 large war relocation authority camps. There were, in addition, dozens of other camps administered by the Justice Department, by the military, and by local authorities all over the place. I might add, parenthetically, that the reason that the United States government gave, well, there are two things they said. One, there's so much anti-Japanese sentiment that you all are going to be safer in these camps. And so that's why Sumiko mentioned that the searchlights and the guns were pointed in, not out. But the other is that Hawaii, which was the point of attack by the Japanese military, there were 100, and I mean of us. I was born in 1939 when you moved to San Leandro. And if I had been in San Leandro at 2 or 3 years old, I would have been taken as a threat to national security. But in Hawaii, about 1,000 people out of about 160,000, there were 160,000 of us there, and about 1,000 people were isolated and incarcerated. So clearly, leaving nearly 160,000 people 2,000 miles closer to the Japanese military and a possible site for invasion, didn't particularly matter to the federal government. So, you know, you can make your own judgment as to why the government decided it needed to do this. What we can say is by the time you got to Tanforan in May, the next month, if you do some searching with military history, on June 4th to 6th in 1942, anybody know why those dates are? I used to hate history. I'm sure you don't do it that way. The way most teachers taught history is learn this date, and you learn what happened on that date. But after you learn why, you start studying why some things happen, then the dates stay with you. Then it makes sense. June 4th to 6th was the Battle of Midway. It was an extremely important battle because it broke the back of the Japanese Imperial Navy. And after that, there was no possibility that an invasion from Japan could take place. So everybody after that, I mean, the camps should have been abolished, even if there was any kind of hint that that was a legitimate cause before then. So you go to, by the way, Tanforan, unbelievably hostile place. I walked around the site, and I think you probably saw it as something a little bit less dreary, but the whole the ground, the earth was alkali, and there's nothing grew there, and it must have been an extraordinary place to try to grow anything. So that's where you spent how many years?
About a little over a year.
A year, and then what?
In the meantime, I have to hand it to the Quakers. They helped us. Other church groups also helped, but they were not visible to us. There was one conscientious objector who went to all 10 relocation centers. A Japanese-American student relocation council was formed with Chancellor of the University of California and the president of Swarthmore College was very active in that. He said later that that was the most rewarding task that he ever had, taking the young people from the camps and finding places, colleges that would accept them. Some places said they couldn't take them because they were doing war work. And since I had grown up near Chicago in the Midwest, I applied to Cornell College, Grinnell College, and one of them, I think it was Grinnell, said they would accept me if they could find a Japanese roommate for me.
They didn't want you to contaminate anybody.
That's right. Well, I wasn't going to wait around for that. So having grown up near a big city, Chicago, I opted for a college near another large city. And so I applied to Drew University in northern North Jersey. Anybody know about Drew University? Oh, lots. So I applied there, and they took me. Drew started as a Methodist seminary for men way back in the 1867 or so. Then the Baldwin brothers left some money for a four-year liberal arts college for men. And then after Pearl Harbor, you know what happened? Between the draft and enlistments, the student body plummeted. So they decided to accept women on a trial basis. Trial basis. We were on a tri-semester schedule, three equal semesters during the year. And so I started at Brothers College of Drew University, which, by the way, still exists and is, I understand, it's one of the most expensive colleges. Yeah. Anybody hear of Drew? Drew University, Brothers College? Yeah. So I attended Drew, and there was a Quaker economics professor who kind of took me under his wing.
So you were one of the fortunate ones,
well,
having spent only a year in the camp.
Oh, I guess so, yeah.
Yeah. What was that year like for you?
Oh, well, I did a lot of drawing when, not painting, but just pencil drawing, when I was in Tanfran because I had the time and leisure. But I had a job in Topaz, so I didn't do any more painting or sketching. But we had several very talented, meaning Okubo, Citizen 1066, I think it is. And but there were other very talented artists. And Topaz was in an area that used to be a lake bed, so there were shells. And people organized, this is not the administration, these are the evacuees. They went, well, they had to get somebody to drive them out into the desert, but they collected shells, and some very beautiful shell jewelry was made there. They're fragile, but I think the Historical Society has some of those shell jewelry. I had some. I didn't make them myself. I had some. But they're very fragile, and with all the moves that we made, I don't have any today. But fortunately, there are some in the museums. I think some are here, and some are in Topaz, where they have just built a museum with the help of the National Park Service, with the help of donations from former evacuees and others. Mm-hmm. So they have completed a museum in the town of Delta, which was the nearest town. The Topaz itself, the camp, was 16 miles outside. And we couldn't, it was surrounded by barbed wire and watchtowers with searchlights. And as a matter of fact, there was a situation where an old man was walking his dog. We had to leave our dog behind. At 16, I didn't have any other possessions except that when they told us no cameras, I had a little brownie camera that I took to the field and buried it. Oh. So somebody at some time might have dug up that little Brownie camera. Anybody here know anything about Brownie cameras?
Well, those were very early cameras. But those were considered contraband. So anything that resembled a weapon or that looked like a camera, because everybody was allegedly perhaps capable of espionage or sabotage. So and people, you know, occasionally would smuggle cameras in, especially later in the mm-hmm. war. Yeah. So we do have photographs taken by the people who were actually incarcerated. And there are now, this is the part of Asian American history that is as probably the most researched and published of all events. It is actually, as I say, it's an extremely important event in American history, and it really deserves, I think, a significant part of AP history, for example, because it is really significant for having put at risk and violated probably every single one of the amendments, the Bill of Rights. I mean, it's really an extraordinary experience for people to have gone through the process of being systematically denied access to all of those rights, even though they were American citizens. The Nisei, the second generation Japanese Americans, like Sumiko and Gordon, whom you heard about earlier, for many of them who had studied the Constitution and really believed in the country, in the values that we espoused, thought that the Issei, the immigrants, because they were enemy aliens, might well be taken to internment camps, is the technical term that was used, like enemy alien Italians or enemy alien Germans. And some of the Germans and Italians were in fact incarcerated. But there was no group of systematically rounded up and incarcerated like of citizens, like the Japanese Americans. Maybe one last thing, one last portion, Sumiko. In high school, did you actually think something was wrong that was happening?
Yes, I knew it was wrong, but when you're guarded by soldiers with guns, with fixed bayonets, you don't argue. So my greatest loss, my own personal loss, was how many of you have pets, dogs, cats? Mm. I received a little toy fox terrier for my 11th birthday, a little puppy that I took home. Palm of my hands, and we had to leave her behind because they told us no pets. Some people had their pets put to sleep, but yeah. We left her with a Spanish family, and in those days, pet food wasn't scientifically, nutritional. They got the leftovers, I think, for the butchering, but we had to leave our pets behind. Some people had them put to sleep. And we understood when people, after Katrina, refused to leave, to be rescued, they stayed with their pets. Mm-hmm. Well, we couldn't do that. So we left her with a Spanish family. But she was used to Japanese food. She even ate Japanese pickles. So, yeah.
Bye. capturing all of this, and but the motivation at the time was for propaganda purposes. Today, as a student, and now this is what I'm saying, is to share with students, if you look, and these photographs are organized by camp name. So I found my Hosu Camp, Topaz, Tule Lake, et cetera. And so if you, and you can download them now for free. They were made available after. Okay. So I encourage you to take a look. It's easy to find, and you'll find tons and tons. And a lot of these photographs, if there's information, they're annotated, so that at least the photographer and maybe the subject name, etc., are accompanied. There's also a subsection in there after the war, when the war ended and people being released. And so you can find photographs of people who were brought to Philadelphia, for example, by the Quakers, etc., in a friendly subfolder. You have to kind of look through it and find them. Thank you.
Okay, 1 second. Does that include Ansel Adams?
Some of his, and then Dorothea Lange, other famous photographers of the day who were hired at one point or another, have their photographs. Online Archives of California, OAC. And if you, that's a kind of odd combination of letters, and you'll find it.
Well, to bring the story up to date, in Delta, Utah, the camp itself was 16 miles outside in the desert, but there is a town called Delta. It was a rail stop on the line, I think, between Salt Lake and Los Angeles. So they have built this museum with the help of the National Park Service and donations from people who used to be in Topaz. And they have built this museum. The building was completed in May. And now they're looking for furnishings typical of that area, of that era. And they're looking for, where was it? Coal pails and radios from the 1945 era. And let's see here, it says, we have compiled a list of some of the items that need to be added to the room. Cotton sheets for pillows. Coal bucket, because it gets cold in Utah. And we had a stove in each apartment. A blanket to be used as a bedspread. If anyone has a 1942-45 radio, and this appeal says, if anyone has these period items would be willing to donate them to the museum, please contact us. They're furnishing the apartments in the exhibit now. But the building itself is completed. And if you're out that way, stop in.
And I didn't want to interrupt the conversation, but I want to make sure that we have time for some questions and enough time for people to take a look at the document. So we do have a few minutes for questions, if anyone has any questions. For.
Oh, my. Well,
and then what happened when you left the camps, when your family left the camps, what happened to you?
Well, we could only take with us what we could carry in our two hands. And we put our storage things in storage in a government warehouse.
Did you get those back?
Yes.
You did.
Yes, we got them back.
Not everybody was that fortunate. I mean, a lot of the storage places were ransacked, and people had to leave farms. I mean, there were a lot of people who were farmers, and so occasionally they would leave the farms in the care of a neighbor, and the neighbor might harvest the crop from that year and not maintain the orchard and let it go to hell. So a few people tell stories about folks who were really decent to them and that they were very fortunate. But the community as a community lost billions of dollars in today's money. I mean, a lot of people were living in places like San Leandro or close to Berkeley or Anaheim in California, in Southern California, which, as you know, became Disneyland. So if they had held on to that property as farms when it got developed, I mean, that was an extraordinary amount of money that was lost. I mean, you really can see the kind of shared commonalities with Native American history or African American history or Latino history, you know, or poor whites or people being sort of run over by events and you know, the inhumanity of that whole process. There's somebody over there. Yeah, so Sumiko was a beneficiary. The Quakers, the AFSC, is one of the few groups, organized groups of any kind, who were consistently opposed to injustice and continue to do that. I have great regard for them. I think that's a remarkable record. Historically, there was the American Civil Liberties Union, you know, ACLU, which sometimes touts itself as being in supportive of civil rights. The Northern California chapter of the ACLU was vociferous in protesting what was happening to the Japanese Americans, but the national ACLU threw them under the bus and said, "No, we have more important things to consider," and never mind, you know. And there were a lot of colleges which refused to entertain the notion, not just because of the there were war kinds of efforts going on, but simply because they thought the Japanese Americans were not welcome there. So it was, you were very fortunate, I think.
Yes.
There were people picked up and incarcerated in military prisons, in jail, local jails. There was one fairly large camp called Honouliuli, which housed prisoners of war and a couple hundred, I think, Japanese Americans. It's closer to Schofield Barracks, between outside in a gully. Out west. Waipahu, more like.
Waipahu.
You know that area.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Not close to Schofield Barracks, but in an area that is now owned by Monsanto.
Yes.
And I think it's being slowly researched, and they're doing some archaeological work on that. So I think National Park Service, as Sumiko mentioned, is throwing some money at this. That project, by the way, is one that began maybe 6 years ago, and the Congress appropriated like $38 million for this. So the camps like Topaz, Tule Lake in California, Manzanar in California, Poston in Arizona, some of those camps are being fairly well taken care of, even those where, as Sumiko said, in terms of buildings, nothing's left. So if you go to Topaz, you can see the outlines of barracks and the hospital, but there's nothing left. I mean, it is totally barren.
Old shoes.
They were all destroyed.
Yeah. Well, you know, some of it was destroyed. The government sold off some of the barracks to and farmers in neighboring farms bought the dwellings and transported them inexpensively to be used as barns, sheds, or sometimes even for their own dwelling. The government.
So none of the families.
Well, you know, somebody asked. So in 1948, the United States Congress passed what the Japanese Americans called a pots and pans bill to provide redress. So people could apply for up to $2,500 in compensation for things they had lost. Now, mind you, I mean, we had millionaires in the community who had literally lost hundreds of acres or thousands of acres of potato, sugar, cotton, vegetable, you know, truck crop lands. And the most they could get was $2,500 from this. I forget, but I think it's like a total of $48 million was disbursed to the Japanese American community. There were people who... out of principle, said this is nonsense. The amount of money is so low. There's so little compensation that it's an insult, and we're not going to apply. Later in 1988, when the redress bill passed, that provided for automatic payments of $20,000 per person. Still inadequate for having lost 4 years of your life and all your property.
If you were living.
If you were alive August 10th when Ronald Reagan signed that bill, and there were maybe 60,000 people out of 120,000, so about half the folks who had been incarcerated were still alive when Reagan signed that bill. So, you know, there was at least that kind of token payment to some of the folks, and even there, some people refused to accept that money out of principle. It was a very, very sad occasion.
Oh, we had to leave our dog, my dog, behind, but later they relented and said we could send for our dog.
Oh, really?
Our pets. So we sent
you
for
Tibby,
but she had run away. She was used to Japanese pickles.
No, you know, I mean, there are even worse stories. I mean, there are stories of families who killed their pets.
Yeah.
Because you heard that too?
Yeah.
Because nobody was going to take them, and they couldn't just turn them loose in the wild. It was very sad. It just really impossible.
Later on, during the redress movement, I talked to several groups, and one of them was a class of third graders, I think, about 8 years old. And during the question and answer period, hands went up. All the questions were about the dog that we had behind.
Sometimes it's easier to deflect from the human suffering, you know, and you can kind of get your head around an animal, a dog, and the empathy is there. But if you don't like Japanese people anyway, maybe it's not so easy to be empathetic. So maybe you can feel sorrier for a dog.
I think we have time for one more question. Yes.
Anybody?
First of all, I want to say thank you very much. It was great.
There aren't many of us left.
I hope that you've done. What I wanted to ask you is, have you recorded this?
Have you?
Have
Have you been interviewed? Have you recorded this story?
Well, I've written, I have manuscripts for...
Yeah. Here, and I hope you have the opportunity to record it.
Well, yes, we have recorded in the past. And one of them was with the widow of Governor Shep.
Hmm. Oh, really?
She and her friend from New York City went to Topaz to teach. Yeah.
Oh,
and she was trained as a biology teacher. But the camp at that time desperately needed a girls' phys ed paper, a phys ed teacher. So she filled in until they got a qualified teacher. And then she went back to teaching biology. And there's a picture in one of the books about the evacuation where a young boy is holding up a baby snake.
I should add, thank you, Hiro, for talking about the archives. If you're interested in these stories, though, there is a group in Seattle called Densho, at densho.org, and they have hundreds of interviews, video interviews, along with an extraordinary archive of photographs and other things that really easy to find, digitized, so you can search by camp, individuals, or for experiences. So if you're doing a paper, you've got a wealth of material, hundreds of these stories. They're great. They're all really great stories.
And to add to that, if you find the AOACG website, it will also afford links to the various academic institutions which form the network. And one of them is the Japanese American National Museum. But they also, like Densho, have an extensive collection, and they also have a facility in downtown Los Angeles that you can visit anytime. It's the Pringle Museum. And they have been collecting artifacts, family that like, over the years. And they also conduct academic research. I have a professor here at UPenn who did part of his thesis work at JANA when he was a graduate. So,
okay. I want to thank our guests tonight. Great program. And I want to thank everybody for coming out. And again, please take a look at the documents at the back of the room. Some of those drawings that Sumiko talked about are on display in the back there. Thank you.
Doing well. Thank you so much for helping out at Pendle Hill when you spoke.
You're,
I'm Barbara.